Welcome to this edition of Environment Matters with me, Amanda Yorworth. Environment Matters, as always, is the show that brings you news on issues of sustainability and the environment from around the district and from further afield. Now we're going to have plenty of foodie things on the show this evening, but before that, you'll be pleased to know that 165 walkers enjoyed the Hearts Hike at the weekend. Now there's been pledges through the website of nearly £1,500 and £2,000 was made in donations on the day, and the Oxfam Group is hopeful that they will reach their target of £6,000 for water projects in northern rural Kenya. They'd like to give a big thank you to everybody who took part, including the mayor, including the Hearts Asian Women's Association, who provided some delicious refreshments in the form of some wonderful samosas and pakoras, and to the dedicated band of volunteers who gave lots of time to marshal and put up signs and without whom the event would be impossible to run. Now, if you did take part in the Heights Hike, or if you were just out for a walk this weekend, you might have noticed all the beautiful berries lighting up the hedgerows. Gorgeous grey-blue sloes, dark red hawthorn berries, bright scarlet rosehips. So I thought this week we'd find out how we can all enjoy a little of this foraging harvest. And who better to ask than Graham Cooling from Polaris Bushcraft? Let's see what he had to say. Graham, thank you very much indeed for joining me. So, foraged food, I mean, obviously it's for free. Can you see any other advantages in foraged food?
Well, I think apart from actually increasing your involvement with the food, which is really kind of nice compared to the way we often treat food coming from the shops, you know, straight out the packet and into the pan. With some wild foods, there's a bit of preparation, which takes some patience, but it also, you know, it can really kind of make you feel more connected and involved with your food, which is certainly nice.
Yes.
As you rightly say, nutritionally, some wild foods are very, very high in vitamins and minerals and things.
Yeah.
Personally, I just like the historical connection as well. This is how people would have lived in this landscape for a very long time, and whilst to a degree we've lost some of that knowledge, I think it's important to hold on to that what still remains.
That's a good point, actually. Real connection with our roots there, isn't there?
Yeah, pun forgiven, but yes, definitely. You know, obviously we're so used to all of the imported foods that we all buy from the supermarket shelves all the time.
Yeah.
But the more you start to learn about wild food, the more you constantly find yourself seeing stuff everywhere.
Yeah.
To the point where you have to be careful to actually look in front of the car and not out the side windows as you're going along most country lanes, because
indeed,
there's actually so much stuff there once you start to learn a little bit about it.
Yeah. Okie doke then. So what would be your foraging top pick for this time of year?
Well, obviously at this time of year, we're really getting into the season of fruits and of fungi. So fungi are a little bit more specialist, and potentially, obviously, there are some dangerous ones out there. So my advice would always be, with regard to fungi, make sure you are 100% sure what you're picking. And the best way to do that, whilst the internet's a wonderful resource, not everything on there is correct, and books are really helpful, and I would always encourage people to have field guides, but it's best to learn in person from somebody who knows what they're talking about. So when you're introduced to a fungi, you've not just seen a picture, possibly not of great quality, but you've actually handled it, smelt it, learned a little bit about where you might expect to find it, because many fungi only grow in association with certain trees and things like that.
Yeah.
But there's loads of fungi out there this year. I think it's something to do with the warm weather and the damp and dry spells we've been having, but I've never seen the like of it. This year's really lots and lots of fungi around.
Yeah.
And the other thing in this season is obviously all of the fruits. I mean, most people, I'm sure at some point, have picked some blackberries from the bush, but in actual fact, there's lots of other things going on at the moment.
Mm.
There's rowan berries, there's haws, there's white beam.
Yeah.
So there's lots of other things that maybe we all walk past all the time but don't necessarily think of as food.
Okay, then. So let's just talk about a few of the berry type things. So one thing I've seen people picking quite a bit of is sloes. Now I've heard of sloe gin. Is that the only thing we can do with them? Is that a good thing, or is there other things we can do with sloes?
Sloes are primarily used for sloe gin, or for kind of mixing in with other things to make sauces and seasonings, but for, as anybody will know who's ever tried one straight off the bush, they are phenomenally astringent. They really, really dry your mouth out.
They really do. That's quite. I don't know anything that's quite so mouth-puckering as a sloe.
Most definitely.
Yes.
But I think, quite possibly in the past, we might have appreciated the sugars in that and thought of them as more of a sweet thing than we do today, because I'm fairly convinced that over time we've changed our palate quite a lot. If we were living purely on a wild food diet, without all the sugars that we all consume today, then obviously I think our expectations that our palate has would be quite different. I've certainly seen people living in the wilderness for months on end who've almost become addicted to sloes, and it's the sugar rush that they're getting, rather than the overriding thing being the astringency that you and I would taste if we were to just go and eat one right away when we've been eating our normal diet recently.
And presumably all the kind of things that make a sweet commercial berry good for us would also apply to sloes as well. So, you know, as you say, whilst they might not necessarily appeal so much to our palate, there's probably still lots of good nutritious stuff in there.
Yeah, most of these wild fruits actually have loads of nutritional stuff in there, and it's not necessarily widely known. It's all that's always useful when you've got a few books and guides to refer to for that sort of thing. But I mean, we just mentioned rowan berries, which are hanging from the trees on many streets around at the moment. 100 grams of fresh fruit from a rowan tree has got 550 milligrams of vitamin C in it.
Wow.
Which is obviously, you know, a fairly heavy amount. And again, thinking historically, if we were going into winter when our fresh foods are going to diminish and we're going to be eating a lot of smoked meats and a lot of dried things, from the natural environment, you're not going to be able to get much vitamin C. So preserving berries, you know, making kind of jellies and fruit leathers and things like that would have been a really important way of getting those vitamins through the lean months.
Indeed. So I'd heard that rose hips were particularly nutritious. Again, lots and lots of vitamin C. Have you ever tried making rose hip syrup or anything like that?
Rose hip syrup is a really brilliant thing to make because it's pretty straightforward. There's not many things you could confuse with a rose tip. There's a couple of different types out there. There's Rosa canina, our native dog rose, and there's a Japanese rose hip that's actually quite a lot more plump and has quite a lot more flesh to it. But you can use either of them for making rose hip syrup. The vitamin C content can be, and it obviously varies with different studies that have been done, but it can be up to 1,000 milligrams per 100 gram of fruit with dog rose. It also contains vitamin A, several of the B vitamins, and vitamins P, K, and E. So quite an impressive kind of CV nutritionally speaking.
I was going to say, if somebody was ever making money out of rose hips, I'm sure they would have been classified as a superfood, wouldn't they?
Yeah, most definitely. It's unfortunate that it's one of those things that there's not a real incentive for any commercial organisation to start trying to promote that, because the minute they do, we're all going to recognise the value of what's just growing in our hedgerows and on our bushes, perhaps.
Absolutely.
Rather than spending money with whoever might be, you know, trying to market that sort of thing. So the incentive's not perhaps there for food companies.
Okay, then. So rose hip syrup looks like a good thing. Now, something, I had a quick look on the internet, and something there seemed to be a bit of sort of like disagreement on, elderberries, are they poisonous or are they not poisonous?
This is an interesting one. Elderberries are something that some people can eat and others do not get along with. When I was a child, I used to eat elderberries off the bush at the bottom of the garden because nobody ever told me that I shouldn't.
Yes.
And I never had a problem. Obviously, elderberries are used in lots and lots of different things. Syrups are fantastic as a kind of cold remedy and a bit of a winter pick-you-up. Mm. So they're not carte blanche toxic, nobody should eat them, but as with any food stuff, really, when you think about allergies and what have you, you should always try a very little first and see how you get on. Because some people really don't get on with elderberries and others are absolutely fine and can eat them all day long.
I'd also seen that the berries on the whole tend to be okay, but the other bits of the plant are poisonous, definitely, and you should leave those alone. So you really have to be careful just to get the berries and not the little stalks and things. Is that right?
Well, elderflowers actually can be eaten.
All right.
So obviously, and if you're eating them, you're going to have stalk attached because the flowers are absolutely tiny. They're what they call an umbellifer. So you've got like an umbrella of very, very small flowers.
Yeah.
And you can actually batter, believe it or not, and fry the entire flower head. But That's very, very fine stalks and smaller parts of the plant. I certainly wouldn't suggest trying to eat any other bits of it, and they wouldn't be too good to eat anyway.
Whereas no.
It's a little bit more woody.
Okay, then. So elderberries are pretty good, as you say, for making things like cordials and wine. But as you say, you just have to be a little bit careful, as indeed with all of these things. Now, just quickly, moving on to nuts. Now, in my experience, most nuts that are worth eating, the squirrels get there before we do. But are there any decent nuts out there that you think that we might be able to find?
Well, it's funny you should say that, because I've just seen a large bag of sweet chestnuts that my wife kindly collected for me today whilst I was teaching. So the sweet chestnuts are definitely starting now. They're just beginning to fall. They can be obviously roasted and eaten, as we're perhaps familiar with people, selling them in Oxford Street at Christmas time and that
yes.
sort of thing. But you can actually grind the nuts up and use them mixed with flour and make incredibly nutty tasting cookies that kids love. So that's how we like to use them.
Wow, that does sound quite delicious. That really does do. So, yeah. Okay, then. So some delicious sounding, you say, very nutritious ideas there. Let's just talk quickly about some practicalities. So obviously identification is very important. We don't want to end up being poisoned. Any tips there for what we might do to avoid that?
There's really no hard and fast rule. There's lots of old wives' tales kicking around. You know, if you've seen snails eating it, then you can eat it. Not correct. If you've seen birds, etc., etc. But in truth, there's nothing. There's no hard and fast rule of thumb that you can follow in ignorance, if you like, and apply it across species of plants or fungi.
Okay.
So it really is important that you know what you're looking at.
Right.
That said, it's quite easy to concentrate, if you fancy a bit of foraging, concentrate on a few species that are really hard to misidentify.
Yeah,
and begin
right.
there, and then obviously if it's something that you stick with over time, you're going to build up that knowledge, and in time and with the right direction, particularly with anything that could be mistaken for toxic ones, you'll gain the confidence to correctly identify things and be absolutely certain.
Right. So as you say, starting with things like the rose hips.
Yeah, the rose hips, for example. I mean, a hazelnut, a sweet chestnut. Those things that you're
yes.
really familiar with and you're 100% certain in what
yeah.
it is,
okay.
Is a great place to start.
Okay.
But with both plants and fungi, there's fairly few that are very, very poisonous, but they are out there, and obviously you can't afford to make a mistake with those. So whilst the poisonous species are relatively few and far between,
you can't afford
to take risks.
Okay.
You need to be sure about what you're picking.
Okay. And then also, do you avoid picking things near to busy roads?
I try to, but by the same token, I often find myself succumbing to temptation, certainly on the country lanes. You wouldn't find me foraging at the side of a major dual carriageway
yeah.
and roads that carry really heavy amounts of traffic, but I do find kind of quite busy A roads. Frustratingly, often tend to have wide verges with absolutely loads of stuff growing
okay.
there. So
perhaps just washing things carefully.
I try to be sensible and not pick stuff from anywhere where there's going to be a lot of cars idling
yeah.
and everything really, getting covered in the fumes.
Absolutely.
But by the same token, there was a study done recently that was talking about how the roadside verges really should have some sort of protection, because they are the most diverse places in this country these days for our native species.
Indeed. And then also, as you said, that often the places where we are foraging are important for wildlife. So I suppose just a message about moderation as well, and make sure you leave enough for wildlife and I suppose for other people as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the things that you do tend to find is if somebody starts foraging somewhere and a few other people drive past and think, oh, what's that person up to? The chances are somebody else will come and have a look after you've gone. And you will have, whether it's nuts or berries, there will be lots of wildlife that's dependent on the resources in a given area as well. So as a rule of thumb, it's good practice to try not to take anything more than a sixth of what's present at the time. And then that way you're leaving plenty for everybody else, wildlife included, and not, denuding a particular area and preventing regeneration. Because obviously all of these things that we're interested in at this time of the year ultimately are looking to regenerate the plants, whether it's nuts or fruit.
Absolutely. Graham, that's fantastic advice there. Thank you very much indeed for coming and telling us about that.
My pleasure.
And I was talking there to Graham Cooling of Polaris Bushcraft. And I'll pop some foraging tips for you on the programme blog on the Radio Verulam website, plus Graham's website details if you fancy learning a little bit more. Now, talking food, the St Albans Food and Drink Festival is now underway until the 7th of October. And everything you need to know about the food festival you can find on the Radio Verulam website. And we're joining in here on Radio Verulam with a week of special festival lunchtime shows. And in each of these, I talk to a local food hero working to make our food more sustainable. Now, you're going to be familiar with some of my guests. Today, I spoke to Emma from St Albans Refuse the Straw. And tomorrow, Ruby Rout tells us about the work she's doing in schools with food waste ninjas. On Friday, there won't be a special show because it'll be a special out and about show. But the festival lunches are back on Monday with Danielle from the Cobbled Kitchen, who's championing vegetables and giving us tips on how good cooking can help us cut food waste at home. Now, with another successful season of open food gardens chalked up this year, Romaine Hutchison will tell us what it's all about on Tuesday lunchtime. And on Wednesday, Bianca Badham, she talks about the wonderful food growing that they're doing at Earthworks. And then finally, Janet Bruce from Food Smiles rounds things off on Thursday with news about this wonderful local food growing initiative. So do listen in to Radio Verulam between noon and one to hear all those wonderful sustainable food heroes and lots more delicious stuff. And you can, of course, if you missed any of those, you can, of course, listen again on the Radio Verulam website. You might also be interested to know that Danielle from the Cobbled Kitchen is running a Cobbled Together Veggies workshop. It's another one of her popular workshops in her own home. Again, you can find information on the Radio Verulam website. It costs £35, but that includes all your ingredients and you get to take home all the food that you made. And you need to book via the website. Now, you can find out all the information from today's show on the environment page of the Radio Verulam website, where you can listen at leisure to the podcast. Remember, we always love to hear from you if you've got any ideas for shows or things you'd like us to cover. Until next week, though, thank you very much for listening.